Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carillo.
This is Pam Shriver.
This is Yannick Noah.
Hi, this is Ricky Herbert from Sydney, Australia, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Well, hello, folks, and welcome to your weekly tennis podcast, introduced beautifully there by Ricky Herbert in Sydney, Australia. Ricky Herbert sounds like a sort of children's TV presenter name or a sort of, you know, children's entertainer type name. Anyway, Ricky, hope you're not offended by that. Thanks very much for introducing the show. David's here. Hello, David.
Hello. Yeah, thanks very much, Ricky. I like the idea of having a children's entertainer introducing the podcast. That's absolutely fine by me.
Thank you, David, for saving me there. Matt, how are you?
Hello, I'm very well, thanks. If Ricky were French, he would have a tennis player name because he would be Ricky Air Bear.
Oh, yes.
Oh.
Yes.
But he's not.
Where is Pierre-Hugues Herbert?
Injured, I think.
Goodness me, he's not been around for... I'd forgotten about him. Is Pierre-Hugues Herbert not playing and Nicolas Mahut is?
That is correct.
Or is Mahut retired?
Yeah, Mahut is playing.
Is Mahut retired?
No, he's playing
Will
doubles.
He ever retire?
He's playing doubles. He got to the final this week in...
Right. Yes, okay.
Somewhere. Marseille, I think.
And he's also been quite outspoken about some certain things that I haven't really been following, but I've been aware of it creating a bit of a commotion.
Well, he was one of the first tennis players to speak out about Peng Shuai, wasn't he? Nicolas Mahut,
yes,
to put something
true
out on his social media. Don't know what he's been talking about more recently. Obviously not nearly as up to date on the big Nicolas Mahut Pierre-Hugues Herbert news. As I ought to be. But anyway, we've led with the big headlines.
Sorry for taking us in that
always
direction.
And now I've basically advertised the fact that the three of us haven't been following one of the stories of the tennis world here on the Tennis Podcast. So, you know, I've given with my letting you off the hook with the children's entertainer line, Catherine, and now I've just completely stumped us with the old tennis stuff.
Yeah, it's going brilliantly, isn't it? Yeah. 1 week today, folks, we will all be on planes to Indian Wells. Well, to LA, where we will then pick up the keys to our... What kind of vehicle, David? What are our wheels?
All I know
something big,
is it
because
says,
packing
yes
is... there's a lot of luggage happening for me.
It says full size is all I know. So
great.
I don't know... Full size what exactly? We'll soon find out. But pictures will be forthcoming when we get there,
pictures
and we can fit
will,
two of our
it's going to be
hashtag
content
in
heaven, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm excited. 7 days to go. We're going to Indian Wells, courtesy of On Location, the premium hospitality and experience provider. They're sending us to Indian Wells. They're sending us to the bracket sunshine, although. Did check out a weather forecast this week, folks, and the one thing that On Location can't sort out for your trip is the bloomin' weather. 4 degrees and sleet, folks, is not what I came for.
Getting
what
that
on
out
earth
of the way last
what
week, Catherine.
What on earth?
It's been really bad, hasn't it, in
really,
in
really
California.
Bad. There's it made the news in the UK today that it's snowing in LA. Well, that can
really
bog off. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But anyway, do
everything
book yourself.
Else they can sort out.
Everything else they can sort out. Do book yourself a trip to a tennis tournament with Steve Fergal's International Tennis Tours. They're offering 5% discount on all trips throughout 2023 for Tennis Podcast, friends of the Tennis Podcast. So become a friend. The link to do so is in our show notes. Support the pod and get yourself a discount code to go somewhere that is advertised as sunny, but may may fail
probably,
to deliver on that
probably
promise.
Probably be sunny.
Will almost certainly be sunny unless you're grossly unlucky. You've got 7 days to turn it around, Indian Wells weather forecast. I'm relying on you to do just that. Now, let's talk about the tennis that we've just seen in the week gone by, including some really fascinating tournaments, actually. We're going to start in Dubai with the WTA 1000 event. Actually, we're going to start in Dubai and Doha, because I'd like to kick off with a rant, please, about the fact that these two finals, both of them fascinating, both of them appointment viewing, particularly for people that, you know, record podcasts about tennis, both of them scheduled at the exact same time. Iga Świątek against Barbora Krejcikova in Dubai and Daniil Medvedev against Andy Murray in Doha. Two finals scheduled at exactly the same time. Footnote to this is that that time was bang smack in the middle of a children's birthday party that I had committed to attend. So I was able to watch precisely neither live. I've obviously caught up with them afterwards. But even if you didn't have a one-year-old's birthday party to attend, the entire global audience of tennis was unable to watch both those finals live. It's appalling. It's appalling. It's absolute crap.
Yep.
Anything to add, anyone?
No, it's so bad, and it happens so often. These matches happened literally simultaneously. They started at the same time and finished at pretty much the same time. I was focusing on Krejcikova and Świątek, and I was, you know, pretty happy with that decision. But what it did mean is that I really did struggle to keep up with what was happening in Murray versus Medvedev over in Doha. And I just find it a classic case of tennis shooting itself in the foot. This was a sort of blockbuster lineup that tennis fans everywhere would have wanted to watch both of those matches, and they couldn't. And I'm at a bit of a loss for words, really, at why tennis keeps doing this to itself. It, you know, so much for tennis united. This would be a way of actually making tennis meaningfully united, so that you can watch ATP finals and WTA finals that you want to watch. I mean, it just makes sense, doesn't it?
It should be a Super Sunday situation, like with the football that we have here in the UK, where it's scheduled so that if you're a football fan, you can sit down at midday or whatever, and that's your Sunday taken care of. You know, if you want to spend your day watching sport, then you'll just be catered for. Now, I know that you've got issues like in a lot of territories, a lot of countries, you've got different rights holders for the men's and the women's in tennis, and you've got the fact that you don't know exactly how long a tennis match is going to be, so it's impossible to schedule them so they're guaranteed to be back to back. Okay, all of those things are true, and make it slightly more complicated than with football, but they are workable. You can work within those parameters to create something decent. I think something, you know, that looks a little bit like a Super Sunday type situation. What we have here is the other end of the spectrum. It's almost like a troll to tennis fans. That's what it feels like. We're going to make it physically impossible for you to watch the two matches of the day. It's ridiculous. And we live in an age now where it's pretty much impossible to keep yourself from results and live scores.
And I did suggest it to Catherine, and she said I'm pathologically incapable
of it. Yeah, yeah. I knew that I'd be standing in the corner of that one-year-old's birthday party checking live scores, because I didn't want to have to not check the Tennis Podcast WhatsApp group, which would have, you know, information about it. I didn't want to have to not see my family WhatsApp group, which would inevitably have chat about those two matches. It's really hard these days to not be aware of what's going on live, I think. So sort of relying on any kind of replay type argument to defend the scheduling, I think is pretty flimsy in this day and age.
No question. A few things. I think the argument that one or two people, dissenting voices who complained about me always complaining, made about this is that tournaments are individual entities who will schedule their own final in a time zone and at a time of day that suits them and their local market, which I do understand. I would answer, well, okay, all they need to do is move 1 hour forward for one of them and 1 hour back for the other one. That's not much of a difference, and you've created a clear 2 hour window to get both of those matches in. Secondly, I think where we are falling down in our assessment of this is we're saying, why does tennis keep doing this to itself, as if tennis is this individual entity where everybody works together? It is not that. It is a fragmented sport full of not even competing interests, just disinterested interests, if you like. I actually have asked around a little bit in the last 24 hours to try to get it. I've been trying to find out why this happens, and I have sent an email to both tours. I've yet to have a response. I did only send it last night, but I want to know whether there's any desire for this to be avoided. Generally speaking, is it not a good idea for the ATP and the WTA to avoid a clash with their finals so that they both can be viewed back to back and both and not have to compete for the same audience? So I want an answer to that. The answer may well be, and I've worked in a tournament for 25 years, I know that the tournament itself wants to schedule itself when it feels is the best, right, for its own interests and for its own broadcaster. But I think that the tours should have a rule about it. I think the tours should demand, yes, you can schedule exactly when you want, as long as you're not scheduling up against the other one that's on at the same day. And therefore, we're going to have to get together. We're going to have to work this out so that there is a clear pecking order or a clear schedule, and maybe you get your choice 1 year and they get their choice the next year. I don't know, but something needs to be done in order so that that can happen. But asking around people within the sport, one suggestion that was made to me this morning is that it's not a case of the two tournaments or the two tours not thinking this is important per se, i.e. dismissing that idea. It might even be that they just simply don't think about it. It's just not even on the agenda. And therefore, the tournaments just schedule it when they feel like it, and nobody thinks about that until it sort of happens. Now, I really hope that's not the case. And the tours are very welcome to reply to my email and tell me, no, we do want that, the same as you do, but there's more to it than that, and those things are A, B, and C. And once I'm told those things, I will happily come here on the Tennis Podcast and tell you what they are. I know that tournaments do have their own concerns and priorities, and they may not be the same as us, the international audience, who are trying to watch all of these matches all the way around the world. And I do get that. But you cannot tell me that there is not a solution to this, and that that solution is not important, because it is.
Yeah, and whatever the justification, it might be in the best interest of the tournaments, but it's certainly not in the best interest of that's such a narrow way of looking at it, isn't it? Because surely the good of tennis is ultimately the good of the tournaments. Anyway, shall we talk about the tennis that we really did our very best to be able to watch? Let's start in Dubai with Barbora Krejcikova's incredible run to her first ever WTA 1000 title. She beat Iga Świątek in the finals 6-4, 6-2. She beat all of the world's top three. She had also beaten Aryna Sabalenka and Jessica Pegula, saved four match points earlier in the tournament against Daria Kasatkina. It was an incredible week for Barbora Krejcikova, who's had a pretty tough time over the last 18 months, hasn't she? I know this form has been coming for a while. There was the win in Ostrava last year, where she also beat Iga Świątek in the final, and I'm sure we'll talk about that a little bit. This form hasn't come out of nowhere. She's had a good run of fitness for a little while now, but before that, since winning that French Open title, it's been really, really tough for her. I remember her having to pull out of the doubles at the French Open last year, losing in the first round of her title defence. I think, you know, it turned out she was suffering from COVID. That's what forced her to pull out of the doubles. I really felt for her at that time, and I was starting to think, oh God, is she a cursed player? Can a Grand Slam champion be a cursed player? This is proof that, okay, this wasn't a Grand Slam, but the way she won this title, these two wins now over peak Iga Świątek, they are proof, enough for me anyway, that her winning that French Open was no flash in the pan. She is a quality tennis player that belongs at the top.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think the word that so often comes to mind for me with Krejcikova is deceptive. And I think that applies to her actual game. Like, I think the way she plays is quite deceptive. You know, the way she sort of holds her ground strokes till the last minute and you don't really know which way she's going to play. And also just how we think about her, because yes, she is a Grand Slam champion and a multiple Grand Slam champion in doubles as well, which I also think serves her really well in these big matches. But she has had that, you know, those struggles that you mentioned since the Slam win. And it's always quite difficult to work out just how good she actually is, I think, for me anyway. And I think this result against Świątek and that one in Ostrava last year really confirms that at her best, she is right up there among the top players in the world. And honestly, this win to me feels like it shakes up the WTA tour a little bit, because Iga Świątek was beating everyone easily, like barely dropping games against some of the best players in the world. And I was beginning to think, well, Iga Świątek, you know, doesn't seem to really have a rival when she's playing well. She's head and shoulders above the rest of the field. That was how it was sort of starting to feel with her form this year, and taking into account everything she did last year as well. And yet now in Barbora Krejcikova, she's got someone who she is not going to want to see in her path ever, I think, because what struck me most about this match was how completely unfazed Krejcikova was about Świątek. You know, I think some players step onto court against Świątek and they're kind of already a bit beaten because of Świątek's aura in a way. And honestly, this one from the start felt like the other way around. It felt like Świątek was already a little bit nervous about playing Krejcikova because she knows that Krejcikova's game can cause her problems. And I don't think I've ever seen Świątek look more flustered and unsettled in a big match. You know, quite early on, she went down a break. She was sort of arguing with the umpire about a time violation that she got. She sort of kicked a ball away at one point after missing a serve. There were just lots of signs that she was frustrated. And I think Krejcikova caused a lot of that with her game and her demeanor. And she was awesome in this match. And I think she caused Świątek to sort of have a bad day in a way that no one else recently has really been capable of doing in these last couple of weeks. I think from a Świątek perspective, it's quite interesting. It does raise this sort of slightly odd question of, has she been winning too easily in a way? You know, like when you look at her results this year, in the losses she's had, there hasn't been a lot of resistance. You know, she got blown away by Pegula in United Cup. She lost pretty easily to Rybakina at the Australian Open. She lost pretty easily here. And it does seem at the moment like she's either winning really easily or losing quite easily. She's not toughing out a lot of wins. And I just wonder whether that's a factor in this sort of match. But that's to take nothing away from Krejcikova, who, yeah, I thought was, absolutely outstanding in this match and in this tournament.
She's so comfortable being a disruptor, isn't she, Barbora Krejcikova? I think she, like Rybakina after winning Wimbledon last year, has had a bit of a chip on her, or had a bit of a chip on her shoulder after winning the French Open, about the treatment that she got on the tour and from the tennis world, sort of not really looked upon as somebody with Grand Slam champion status. She's had some dodgy court assignments over the course of the last couple of years, hasn't she? And she's really, really used that as fuel, and I think lent in to being, to not really giving two hoots about what anyone thinks about her or who's down the other end of the court. She's going out there and she is doing her thing, and she's totally uncowed by Iga Swiatek. Whilst everybody else is racking up mental baggage against Swiatek, she's doing quite the opposite. She's, I imagine, drawing immense confidence by the fact that she's scoring these victories over her. Now, is it, David, that Barbora Krejcikova has figured out some kind of Iga Swiatek cheat code? Or is it just that her game happens to match up really well, her natural game happens to match up really well against Swiatek's?
I see it about being, as being about Krejcikova as a tennis player more than anything else. And I look at the players she beat over the course of this tournament. She beat the top three in the world. She beat Aryna Sabalenka, who had been unbeaten all year. And then she's done this in the final. And the way it seems to me is, you know, we often define a player, we describe a player, we label a player as a power player or somebody who's got a great forehand or a great serve and maybe has a weakness here, like Coco Gauff has that forehand hitch that often makes us think, oh, there's something to pick on. I don't really see anything like that in Krejcikova's game. I don't see any massive weapon that is going to be concussive on its own and be the reason she wins every match. If somebody asked me to describe what sort of player she is, I'd say she's a really, really good tennis player, like a complete player. She's got everything, but not one thing that stands out above all else. I mean, watching that final back made me wonder, Matt, whether she's ever been consideration for the backhand list, because it is so picturesque. It is so fluid, that shot. She's got a really big high take back and then this swish through the ball, which is made more exaggerated by the sort of very light-coloured frame of the racket she uses. I remember when she won the French Open, I'd describe it as like a lightsaber, and it brought back memories of the Jimmy Connors fluorescent yellow racket in the 1991 US Open run. But I just think that no matter what Swiatek's doing against her, she's able to time the ball back and put the pressure back on her. There's no panic in her ground strokes. There's no sort of anxiety or desperation to hit big early because it's Swiatek down the other end of the court. She just trusts her own ball strike, her own game, her own foundations, and all the doubles she plays. And that lovely line she said last week in an interview, I think maybe with Ream, about how she watches loads more tennis than anybody else. You know, she watches all the matches that are on. She's often seen courtside watching matches because she loves to watch the best players in the world play tennis. I really think that's a good sort of sign of somebody who gets tennis, because they love it. They watch it all the time because it's a great sport, and it rubs off on her in her own game.
She watched the Sabalenka-Rybakina final in Australia, didn't she? Wasn't she courtside for that?
Yes,
and we were trying to pick her out in the crowd, weren't we, Matt?
Mm. But failing.
Unable to do so. We found Max Rushton from the Guardian Football Weekly, but we couldn't find Barbora Krejcikova.
Yeah, and to answer your question, David, absolutely. She has been in consideration for the backhand list. I think I'm probably guilty of what Catherine was describing and the sort of tennis world sort of undervaluing Barbora Krejcikova since that French Open win. Because honestly, I do watch a match like this and it does feel like she has one of the very best backhands in the world. And it's also incredibly pleasing. As I said, the way she holds it till the last minute, I find is something that she can do that others can't. And I wonder whether that's something that is disrupting Iga Świątek a little bit. And then just in terms of your question, Catherine, about whether it's Krejcikova specific or sort of has she provided a bit of a blueprint, I agree with David. I think a lot of it is Krejcikova specific, but I would say in the three losses that Świątek's had this year, one thing that I've really noticed is players kind of dismissing her serve, like really deep, aggressive returns. And Pegula did it, Rybakina did it, and Krejcikova especially did it in this match. And I know Świątek listed her serve as one of her many, many strengths when she was asked for them in Australia. But personally, I do see that as a little bit of a weakness, if there are any, in her game. If you can exploit that second serve, get on top of it, I think that is an area. And all three of those players who've beaten her this year have managed to do it. Much easier said than done, I'm sure. But I felt that was kind of a bit of a foundation for this win for Krejcikova.
I've just been looking up sort of who's been beating Krejcikova this year, because as I said, she's been fit for a good streak now, hasn't she? Sort of, why have we not really talked about her much over the course of 2023? She lost to Kudermetova 7-6 in the third in her opening match of last week in Doha. So that's, you know, that's obviously one that could have gone either way. Lost to Pegula in straight sets. That match on the John Cain Arena, wasn't it, at the Australian Open? So, yeah, I suppose, who did she lose to in Adelaide? Sorry, I'm very clearly just, I've Googled Barbora Krejcikova and I'm running through the Google results. Lost to Kazakina in Adelaide. So she's been losing to good players, but I suppose building up form.
And I think even in this tournament, she had to build up form. Like, she had to save those match points against Kazakina. She was, what was it, 6-1, 3-love down, I think, against Sabalenka, like, before mounting this incredible comeback. Like, it was quite likely that she wasn't even in this final. She had to overcome a lot of hurdles. She had to build up that confidence as it went. And there was quite a funny moment where, because they do the doubles trophy ceremony at the same time as the singles in Dubai, after both finals have been completed, they brought out the doubles players and both of them sat with Krejcikova, and sort of Świątek was sort of left on her own. I suppose it made sense to sit with the winner. It was probably just a bit less awkward. But it did so happen that Kudermetova and Samsonova, the last two players to beat Krejcikova in singles, won the doubles and were then sitting next to Krejcikova.
Oh, very good.
On the bench. Yeah, there was quite a sort of funny moment there.
Very
it was
good.
Very tennis.
Samsonova had beaten her
in Abu Dhabi. Mm-hmm.
So Świątek just sat there on her own while Samsonova, Kudermetova and Krejcikova are just having a sort of winner's party.
Yeah.
Ceremonies are brutal in tennis for the losers, aren't they? I'd rather lose in the semi-final because you don't have to sit on the court and watch your your opponent collect their winnings. I do think that is just an awful thing about being a runner-up, not just in tennis, all sorts of sports do it. And I watched Newcastle have to walk up the Wembley. I mean, I didn't feel a tremendous amount of sympathy for them, but had I been a Newcastle fan. Tough scenes at Wembley yesterday, watching them trudge up those steps to collect their runners-up medal.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Saving match points probably leads us on nicely to Doha and the ATP 250 event there, won by Daniil Medvedev, beating Andy Murray 6-4, 6-4 in the final. Second title in a row for Medvedev, who really seems to have found it. It's going to be interesting seeing him try to take that form into Indian Wells and Miami, two tournaments where he's done very little in the past. This isn't a period of the season where he's done well before. But he is very good at doing well in new places, isn't he? I think all of his titles have come in different locations in the world. So maybe he'll never win a title twice. Maybe that'll be his weird, quirky record. And look, we will talk about Daniil Medvedev. But I think perhaps first of all, because it's been a bit of a theme of our year, which it feels like most of it on the tennis front for me has been spent watching Andy Murray dig himself out from absurd situations. He saved match points in just the two matches last week in Doha. He was two match points down against Lorenzo Sonego, so that's the second Italian he's beaten from match point down in 2023. And a cool five match points saved against Jiří Lehečka in the semi-finals, including coming back from 5-4, 40-love, three match points on the Lehečka serve in the third set. Andy Murray won 5 points on the bounce there to break the Lehečka serve and come back to win, and had this beaming broad smile on his face when he did that. And Matt and I watched that match together, and watched the majority of that match together, and I felt like he gave you the reaction there, Matt, that you've been wanting to see from Andy Murray this year.
Yeah, I mean, look, I know he loves it. I absolutely know he loves winning matches in that fashion. You know, he lives for it, I think. And I guess that's why I want him to be happy about it, because I know he lives for it. I know the sacrifices that he makes to be able to make it possible. And yeah, it just struck me after the Berrettini win in Australia that he didn't seem that happy about it. And I think in hindsight, he probably wanted to wrap that up in straight sets at the time. He probably knew there would be a kind of knock-on effect to not winning that match more easily. But in Doha, he was able to sort of back up each win after each win and keep this run going. And the more he did it, the more he seemed like he just really enjoyed it. And that was replicated in our reactions as well, wasn't it? It was kind of impossible to watch that and not just burst out laughing, because it is kind of absurd what Andy Murray is doing this year. And I do think the next step for him is trying to win some matches more easily in straight sets. He hasn't done so since Gijón last year, which was in October. He's played 14 matches since then, none of them straight sets wins. And I do think that would help him, because what this run really demonstrated is that we weren't wrong in Australia when we felt like he was playing really well. You know, his tennis is as good as it's looked in several years, I would say. He seems to be really getting that blend right between attack and defense, and he's going after his forehand in a way that he only does when Ivan Lendl is part of his team. And, you know, if he can just put it together in two sets rather than needing three, I think that will help him. But yeah, the signs for Andy Murray this year are really, really good, and I'm enjoying the ride, I suppose, because that's very much what it feels like.
Yeah, I said to you, didn't I, on Friday, Matt, when we were watching that match, I don't know how much Andy Murray is paying Ivan Lendl to say, hit your forehand, Andy, but I'm willing to do it for less. Whatever that figure is, I'll undercut it. Just hit your forehand. So, it's seeing him hit that forehand the way he has been this year really starkly shows up how not hitting his forehand he was for a couple of years before that. I mean, there really is something different about his tennis this year, I think. And as you say, Matt, it's that blend between defence and attack. He's still playing those trademark Andy Murray points, you know, backing himself to hang in the rally, trusting his movement, I think, in a way that he hasn't for a long time, trusting himself to be able to dig out points where he looks like he's down and out. But he's also taking command of points in a way that he wasn't last year and the year before that. And possibly maybe a lot of more years on top of that. It might be the best tennis he's played since he got that metal hip. I think it very well might be the best tennis he's played since he got that metal hip. But it looks so simple, doesn't it? Oh, he's clearly putting an extra 15 miles per hour on that forehand, and he's looking for opportunities to step into the court and to rip it. He's not backing off it, and I really feel like I could tell him to do that where required for a low price.
I think you could too, but I mean, I do think that's been a trait of his three installments with Ivan Lendl, and for the most part of his career without Lendl, that's one thing he didn't really do, and it seems as though
it's
he regresses
so
when he's not around.
Fascinating, though, isn't it, that he needs Lendl there? This isn't just about Andy Murray and Lendl, isn't it? It's about coaching in general. Sometimes you need to hear something from a particular person's voice. He must know what Ivan Lendl's going to tell him. Hit your forehand, yeah. Andy.
It's a psychology, isn't it? There's a lot going on mentally there. And because it's Lendl, I'm sure that it's not even entirely conscious, but there's a subconscious at work that he knows. He just feels differently, and it clicks into gear in a match without him probably having to tell himself to do it, because he's just got that ingrained through all the chats and the process and knowing what Lendl thinks, and it's just in there. But I think he does look a player now. I mean, and I actually think he's probably going to have to take it another step further still. Having watched that Medvedev final back, you know, some of these guys are too good from the back of the court. Not that many of them, but you're not going to outlast Daniil Medvedev.
It's not a good matchup for Andy Murray at this stage, is it? Watching that, I watched Medvedev, Felix Auger-Aliassime. Matt bobbed off to watch Fulham draw 1-1 with Wolves. That was his preference for Friday night. But I stuck in there with Medvedev, Felix Auger-Aliassime, which was... He's got a horrible record, Felix, against Daniil Medvedev. Never beaten him. I think this makes it 6-0, which is pretty catastrophic. A record for a peer with a similar ranking, I would say, in a sort of similar age group. I know Medvedev is a few years older, but I think of them in a similar-ish age group. But I was watching that thinking Andy Murray would have a far better chance against Felix Auger-Aliassime. That is a bad matchup at the moment for Andy Murray.
Yeah, I think so. And Medvedev made a real statement, I felt, in the first game of the final, where he just extended some rallies. I think there was a stat going around last week that in his final against Sinner, there were over 60 rallies longer than 9 shots. And I think in the very first game against Murray, there were four of those. And it just felt like Medvedev was locked in immediately in that match. And yeah, generally sort of had the better of those really long exchanges.
Penis in a scribble.
I really hope people remember that reference. Otherwise, you've just randomly said penis in a scribble.
As you were, Matt. Carry on.
That's fine. Matt.
and honestly, I've been really pleased to also have Medvedev back. You know, as great as having Murray, you know, do what he's doing this year is, I've really enjoyed Medvedev these last couple of weeks, and that was also evident in his post match ceremony where he sort of reminded everyone of what a great guy he is to have around. Because first of all, he trashed the balls, saying that he didn't like them. And I thought, yeah, great, you've won the tournament, and yet you're using sort of their platform to trash their balls. Great, so in on all that. And then he made a gag about having match points against Andy Murray and freaking out about it because he knew that that Murray's record is so good coming back from match points.
That was great, wasn't it?
Yeah. He just...
That was really great.
He's just the best, Medvedev, when he's sort of in that mood. And I think we're starting to sort of see that a lot more. It's great.
I'm really interested to see if he can carry this through to Indian Wells and Miami. I think he's found the conditions in Miami challenging in the past. I'm not sure he's a guy that loves humidity. I feel you on that, Medvedev. Although he has reached finals in two finals in New York and one in Australia. So I feel like he might not like it, but he can cope with it. Yeah, Cincinnati as well. And Indian Wells, I don't know, they're very unique conditions, aren't they? Mm. But yeah, he's never really had this form at this time of year before. So we watch with interest. And same goes for Andy Murray. He's pulled out of Dubai this week, had been down to play. His reason is an ongoing hip problem, which I think is what you can call having had a hip replacement.
Yeah, that had the feel of we don't want to say the true reason that Andy Murray's pulled out, which he gave immediately after the Doha final by saying, I'm going to have to think about whether to pull out of events before I get injured from now on. And then a day later he pulls out and it's quite clear that it's just precautionary and totally understandable, albeit I also understand why tournaments like Dubai don't like hearing that, because it doesn't make their events sound like the biggest deal in the world. But to put the ongoing hip problem, when the bloke's had such a massively serious hip problem throughout his last 4 or 5 years and it nearly ending his career. I mean, I know it did make a couple of people think, oh, what else has happened now? And I don't think anything's happened.
I'm glad he's done that, though. It must have been tempted just to hop on that short plane ride and just go to Dubai and see whether you can keep it up. You know, it must
especially
feel really
Djokovic
good,
there.
This tennis he's playing at the moment. That must feel good. You know, He really did love that win over Yuri Lehechka in the semi-finals. He could not stop smiling in that post-match interview. There was a real check me out vibe to it. There was a real, do you see what I just did there? I was 40 love down on the bloke's serve. Do you see that?
I saw what you did. You quoted Simon Briggs. Great moment.
Yeah, he must be very tempted. So I'm glad that he's exercising some self-restraint. And maybe that's the sort of thing that Lendl has input into as well. But again, I could do that. I could say, probably just go home for the weekend, Andy. Take it easy.
And actually, I suppose there is an element here with... He gave some quotes in the past, didn't he, which suggested that when he was with Lendl before, he had overtrained or overplayed or overworked... whichever it may be. And I think we all felt at the time when he was reconnecting with Lendl, they needed to have sort of put that behind them, and they needed to have worked out a schedule which works for Murray now in the shape he's in. And maybe this is a good example of that arrangement, because it does seem very sensible to, you know, not push it, because he's got a good thing going on right now, and he needs to just protect himself.
Definitely. Rohan Bopanna and Matt Ebden won the doubles title in Doha, heading now to Rio and the second biggest title of Cameron Norrie's career. He beat Carlos Alcaraz 5-7, 6-4, 7-5 in the final, the second consecutive week that those two have met in an ATP final. This one, though, was quite a different story. We were all up pretty late last night watching this one with the Alcaraz-Mitav group on fire, with a real roller coaster of commentary, because this match was defined by the fact that Carlos Alcaraz sustained a leg injury, looked like a hamstring injury, when he was 7-5, 3 love up in the match. And at that point, it took on an entirely different character. And I don't know whether this makes me a total sadist weirdo, but I loved the match from that point on. Watching Carlos Alcaraz with a heavily strapped thigh, sort of really barely able to move around the court, shackled in his movement, but trying to end points in sort of 4 seconds or less, and Cameron Norrie trying to cope with this completely bizarre tennis player down the other end of the court. I found it utterly compelling viewing. As much as I'm devastated about the fact that Alcaraz is injured and he'd blooming well better get himself right in the next 10 days for Indian Wells, because I'm not interested in Carlos Alcaraz having to spend more time in the sidelines. Within the match, I found it fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, the bloke pulls the trigger as soon as he possibly can at the best of times. But, you know, in the situation he was in, that was his only option. And it was just comedy, really, to see every rally. And to see Cameron Norrie actually having a very unusual sort of meltdown in parts of that third set, because he suddenly is supposed to win. And there's really not much you could do about some of the points, because I don't care how big your lungs are and all the rest of it that we all talk about with Cameron Norrie's ability to run forever. You'd need to be the road runner in order to catch up those balls that Alcaraz was hitting past him. And then the one forehand that Alcaraz hit on the run down the line, which Norrie was just absolutely convinced was out. And I think it was just total disbelief.
So convinced he did a fist pump.
Yeah, you cannot hit a forehand winner down the line from there. It is not possible. And he was calling it out, and he was pumping the air, as you say. And then Carlos Bernard has just refused to be swayed by this at all, and he came down. And I mean, and when we saw the replay, it couldn't have landed more plumb on the line. It wasn't outside edge. It wasn't a mark touching. There was no mark, because it hit the line flush. And I'm quite sure Norrie will be slightly embarrassed about that now when he watches it back. I understand it. I mean, you're in the heat of the battle. You're just desperate, and you're trying to get over the line. And I mean, I thought his holding it together in the end to still win showed a lot about him, about his character. And in the post-match interview, when he said, you know, I was dealing with a lot of demons out there, because I lost to the guy last week. You know, I've lost a couple of finals. If you think back to the one he lost in Auckland at the start of the year, that really hurt him when he was beating Richard Gasquet, and he should win that, shouldn't he? And he didn't. And he said, I also found it quite interesting that he said, and this isn't really my surface, you know, clay, which I always think is a pretty good surface for him, but he wasn't having that. And anyway, it meant a lot to him, and it was great to watch, but it was great in the micro sense, Catherine, because you're right, this could be another massive blow to Carlos Alcaraz. For all we know, he could be out for weeks and months, for all we know now, and the guy has got to figure out a way to keep himself out on the tour all the time or as much as possible, because he's getting derailed a lot.
And those weeks and months could be more than they would have been had he retired from the match. I mean, there was,
that's interesting.
Very clear that there was absolutely no way he was going to retire from that match. His appetite to play tennis at the moment is so feverish that I think he'd have to be knocked unconscious to be prepared to retire from a tennis match at the moment. And I don't know, maybe the physio told him you're unlikely to do any further damage by playing, but I don't see how you can know that in that moment with what was clearly a significant injury. He immediately had very heavy strapping put on that hamstring. And I get how hungry he is. I love it. I love to see it. A ravenous Carlos Alcaraz that looks like he's been a caged animal for the past 5 months. Brilliant. Bring it on. But stay fit. You've got to be fit to play. Please, for all of us.
Yeah. I think maybe this week, more than the previous week even, I relied on waking up to highlights of Carlos Alcaraz. I didn't see so many of his matches live. And it's a level of excitement he brings that kind of no one else can on the ATP tour, in that you wake up and, incredible forehand's gone viral. And, like, no one else is really doing that. And he's able to sort of combine that shot making with winning in just a way which is unique, I think, and it's breathtaking. And I really, really do hope that he's fit for Indian Wells. On that issue of whether he should have retired or not, like, it's obviously very difficult to say without knowing what the injury is, really. But I do think generally tennis does have a bit of a issue in terms of how it sort of frames people playing through injuries. Like, it's seen as this incredible show of strength and almost a badge of honor, and I'm sure in some occasions it is. And you know, we all sort of marveled at Novak Djokovic being able to win the Australian Open with a tear, but at the same time it's also okay to retire if you are injured and to sort of protect yourself. And I think sometimes that is lost a little bit in the sort of coverage of it, I suppose. And I just always worry about that.
Is this another thing that's Roger Federer's fault?
Well,
I think Federer and Nadal, to be honest, because, and you could say Djokovic based on that Australian Open too, but Federer having never retired from a match in his whole career, that's the ultimate badge of honour, isn't it? Nadal playing through that injury against Taylor Fritz and then having to withdraw from the next round, I mean, and putting himself out for months. It's not good news, actually. And it is tough. And I'm sure, even in his subconscious, Alcaraz would be influenced by those.
Yeah. And just on Norrie, I could be wrong about this. And someone, I'm sure, will correct me if I am wrong. But I don't think he's been home in 2 months. I mean, if he...
He hasn't because he went on holiday to Costa Rica after the Australian Open.
And then Colombia.
Then went to Colombia to play Davis Cup. And I'm sure that the location of that Davis Cup tie has influenced his scheduling decision since then, which, you know, seems smart to me. But this is a heck of a run he's on, right?
And you know, he would have left before Christmas, I think, for United Cup. He then played Auckland, Australia, as you said, went to Costa Rica on holiday for a bit, and then he's played on clay. And I just think it's an example of him choosing a path that we don't really see from other Brits. You know, he did that even by just going to college in the States. And, you know, the way he's now just played this swing on the clay in South America is not something that we normally see from British players. And I think he's the first one. I think he's the first Brit to win one of these titles. And yeah, I just find it really interesting how he has sort of forged his own path in that sense. He is prepared to do things a little differently, and it's worked out way better than anyone ever would have thought. And he's become such a complete player. I agree with you, David. I feel like clay kind of should be a good surface for him. It's certainly the surface that I first saw him on in that Davis Cup tie against Bautista Agut. And But now he's, you know, he's won Indian Wells on a hard court. His best slam result was Wimbledon on grass. He's such a complete player now, and I think it's not an accident. You know, he's worked to become that, and I just, we say it all the time, but we're sort of filled with respect and admiration for what Cameron Norrie's doing, and I think in his mind this will be a really big deal for him, even though Alcaraz did pick up that injury. It's still a win over Carlos Alcaraz in a final, and you know he needed that, I think, and it could sort of propel him even further.
A lot of players would have lost that match against Carlos Alcaraz, for sure. A lot of good players would have lost that match. In the mix for a second Indian Wells title, Cam Norrie, David?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely.
I think...
Especially with no Djokovic.
Pretty much in the mix for everything. I don't know whether I'd put him in the mix at Wimbledon, although he reached the semi-finals, didn't he? But I'd put him in the mix for most things now.
Andres Molteni and Maximo Gonzalez won the doubles title in Rio. In Marseille, Hubert Hurkacz was the singles champion, beat Benjamin Bonzi 6-3, 7-6 in the final. And Edouard Roger Vasselin and Santiago Gonzalez won the doubles. And Matt has very kindly put in the agenda, combined age of 79.
That was how I know that Mahut was still playing, because he was also on that court. And I think he's over 40 now. And he and his partner had a combined age of 76. It was a very old doubles final.
The WTA event in Merida. Camilla Giorgi came back from a breakdown in the decider to beat qualifier Rebecca Peterson 7-6, 1-6, 6-2 in the final. That's her first title since that incredible run she had to win the Montreal title in 2021. And the partnership of Katie McNally and Diane Parry won the doubles. Didn't see any of that. Wish I had seen some of that. Love that partnership.
Me too. I was just thinking that. Yeah, what a fascinating partnership.
Yeah, I don't know if that's just a 1 week thing, but they won the title, so even if it was supposed to be a 1 week thing, maybe they'll extend it and give us the chance to watch them play at future tournaments. In terms of what is happening this week, Dubai hosts the ATP. Novak Djokovic returns to action there. He and Rublev are the top two seeds, with Medvedev third. Medvedev's playing a lot, isn't he? It's a lot of tennis, and he didn't really have an off season because he played all those exhibitions. Be interesting to see if he runs out of gas. As we say, Andy Murray withdrawn as a precaution. First round highlights: Aujelia Seam against Maxime Cressy, Dan Evans against Borna Coric. Like the look of both those two matches. We've also got the ATP in Acapulco. Stefanos Tsitsipas has withdrawn with a shoulder injury that he said he's been struggling with since the Australian Open. That's a little bit of a worry, isn't it, for Stefanos Tsitsipas? Carlos Alcaraz is down to play. Seems unlikely. Kind of hope he doesn't. But as it stands as we record, he is in the draw. And Casper Ruud is the other top seed there. You've got Rune against Ben Shelton, Francis Tiafoe against Yoshihito Nishioka. Fritz is in action there. He's got Isner first round, and Shapovalov against Ketsmanovic. And footnote to what's going on in Acapulco, Matteo Berrettini playing there, unseeded.
Really? Goodness.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Oh, that, how the mighty have fallen. Yeah.
And the other Berrettini note is that his brother has qualified.
All these riff-raff brothers knocking around.
He got a qualifying wild card, I guess, because his brother is Matteo Berrettini, and he made good on it, and he's into the draw to play Oscar Otter.
Right.
And I must say...
What's his first name?
Jacopo.
Okay, I want to see Jacopo Berrettini against Petros Tsitsipas. That I would watch.
There was a funny video going around that Acapulco Instagram put up of Jacopo playing, and someone on Twitter pointed out that maybe the no backhand gene runs in the family, because in this rally he sort of scrambles one back, then he overruns it and sort of pats the ball back on another one, and then on the next one he overruns it again and has to switch and hit a left-handed forehand rather than hitting a backhand. It's a very amusing little sort of 10-second snapshot of his game. But
oh, Jacopo sounds like a fun time.
Yeah.
Okay. Is he the hardest working guy in tennis, though? Because no, he's not. That honour has already been taken.
Petros has got that wrapped up.
The ATP is also in Santiago this week. Lorenzo Musetti and Francisco Cerúndolo, the top two seeds. Dominic Thiem against Christian Garin is a round one match. And the WTA is also in Austin and Monterey. Magdalena and Zheng Shuai, the top two seeds in Austin. Emma Raducanu's had to withdraw with tonsillitis. Such a shame, because I was so pleased to see her entering that tournament. I think that would have been a really good opportunity for her to get a decent draw, hopefully win a couple of matches, get something going. That's just really bad luck for her. Alicia Parks back in action in Austin. Danielle Collins could do with a win, couldn't she? Katie McNally, Elizabeth Mandlik and Sloane Stephens against Taylor Townsend, a round one match there. And in Monterey, Caroline Garcia and Marie Buzkova are the top two seeds, and David has picked Donna Vekic to win the title.
Going to keep picking her until she does.
Pam is there.
She's your Paula Badosa. Pam's there.
Yeah.
Yay.
Hey.
go Pam. And as we mentioned last week, just confirmation that Novak Djokovic now has a total of 378 weeks at world number one and counting. That means he has officially now overtaken Steffi Graf on 377 weeks. We talked about it a bit last week. It is an incredible record, and it's one that's still going. Who knows how many weeks he will end up racking up. It's incredible, and congratulations to him. We have our mascot for this episode. I'm looking at him right now. His name is Crossley. He's owned by Catherine. Same church, different pew. No, different church. Catherine with a K, anyway.
Surely all Catherines are in the same church. Can't have multiple churches.
Yeah, same church, different side of the aisle. Anyway, Kit Wolverton. But Crossley was brought to us and submitted by Amy Suskind. Amy says, submitting this in honour of my childhood friend Kit, who lives in Arlington, Virginia. She, along with her twin, are responsible for my tennis addiction when inviting me to join them as a ball kid at the Cincinnati tournament in the late 80s and early 90s. Kit and I have had many tennis adventures together, including our semester abroad, where Kit came up from Paris to queue overnight with me for Wimbledon. My favourite, though, was Kit having a massive crush on one of the older ball boys, Brad. Are all crushes called Brad? I think they might be. who thought of Kit as a little sister. That is unfortunate. Something that annoyed her to no end. Very relatable, Kit. Years later, they run into each other in Washington, D.C. Oh, my goodness! What? This is... Wow! Years later, they run into each other in Washington, D.C. and have now been married for over 15 years. Oh, I'm going to do a little cry. Their son, Mason, was named after where they first met. Someone make a movie out of that. That was amazing. I'm so grateful to Kit for introducing me to this crazy and wonderful tennis world. Oh, I love that. And I love Crossley. Crossley looks to me like possibly a Labradoodle. I definitely think there's some doodle in there. It's difficult to get a sense of scale from the photo.
He's got like a Mansour Barami moustache.
Big moustache, but that could just be the haircut, David. Billie Jean could have a big moustache if I styled her as such.
Oh, please.
Anyway, there'll be a picture of Crossley in our newsletter. So if you would like to submit your suggestions of what breed he might be, then please do let us know. And thank you, Amy, for that wonderful, wonderful story that has warmed my cockles. Much loveliness. So thank you for that. We have our mascots. David has Maisie. I've got Xenia. And Matt has Darwin. Billie Jean, who has been asleep on my laptop throughout this recording, which is a very sort of early days tennis podcast recording energy, isn't it? It's very, as Matt said, it's very US Open David 2016 vibes, falling asleep on the keyboard. Billie Jean is sponsored by Billie Jean King and Alana Kloss. We have our top folks and executive producers, Jamie, Hannah and Drew. And we have shout outs, Matt.
We have Dana Douglas in Allendale, New Jersey.
Oh, hello.
Great name. Don't know any tennis
great
player
name,
of that.
Great location. Is Allendale, New Jersey, where Bruce Springsteen's concerts during the US Open are?
No.
Not that we're looking that far ahead, so. Really.
I think Allendale's quite small.
No, okay. Okay. Well, there's somewhere in New Jersey that I hadn't heard of.
Is it New Rutherford?
Anyway,
Rutherford?
Thanks for being a friend.
Rutherford, right. Mm. Like Greg Rutherford.
Yeah. A long journey.
And I'm afraid we're going to have to keep talking about New Jersey and come up with new things to say. We've got Noreen Riley in Robbinsville, New Jersey.
Aww.
Hello, Noreen. I think Noreen is our first ever Noreen shout out.
I don't think
we've had a Noreen before.
I love it when we get a new name. And
yeah.
Sadly, I don't know any tennis player Noreens either. So, Noreen, you are a true one-off.
Noreen, thank you. Dana as well. I feel like I didn't do you justice there. I ended up talking about Greg Rutherford. Thank you to you both.
And finally, we've got Kate Fisher-Burrell, who is originally from New Mexico, but now lives just outside Frankfurt in Germany.
Ooh. My brother spent a year living in New Mexico. I'm the only member of my family that has never been to New Mexico. There you go, fun fact.
Sort that out. Kate, thanks a lot for being a
I've
friend.
I've been to Frankfurt Airport.
Yeah, me too.
You'll be there next week, won't you, David?
I'm going to Frankfurt Airport next Monday.
Frankfurt used to host the ATP Finals. Mm. Back in the early 90s. In fact, it was where the Masters, as it was known, moved from New York to Germany to take advantage of the Boris Becker days. And it was brilliant, an amazing atmosphere.
Thank you, Kate, for giving David an opportunity to talk about the 90s.
And Kate has a fun fact. She says, I have something in common with Roger Federer. I have two sets of twins.
Wow.
So cool.
You, Roger Federer, and Nicholas Pfeiffer.
Oh, really?
Oh.
Yes.
And?
Didn't know that.
No. I thought I had another example, but I can't remember.
I'm just
No, it's Federer's sister also has twins, right? But not two sets. I think that's correct.
Is that right?
I think so.
Gosh, that is a lot of twins, isn't it? Lovely. Excellent. Great shout-outs. Thank you, Kate. We'll be back with another tennis podcast. We'll be recording on Sunday of this week because whilst the From the Airport Lounge recording was successful last time around, sort of front-of-house successful, behind the scenes it led to quite a stressful boarding situation for me and Matt. So this time we're gonna play it safe and record on Sunday right before we head to Indian Wells for the first time as a team, courtesy of On Location, the experience, the premium hospitality and experience provider. 1 week and counting, folks. We'll speak to you soon. Oh, I've got it wrong. I've got it wrong. It's Stefan Oudé with the two sets of twins.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.